Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Hello, old friends. I'm Brian Brinkman.
And I am David Goldstein. The date is September 27th, 2021. Hopefully it's a sunny Monday for you, but you should at the very least feel fortunate that you get to listen to The Drop.
Right. Happy Monday indeed. We are in late fall here in Denver, Colorado. I am so happy because I get to wear jeans again. I get to wear long sleeve shirts. It's crisp outside. I can still hang outside at night. The skies are suddenly clear all once again. I can see stars from my back porch. This is the best time of year to be in Denver, Dave. I mean, I know from the East Coast, from living in Maryland, that this is a great time of year up and down the Atlantic coast. But I just got to tell you, like, there's no humidity out here, which is amazing. But the summer, you just feel like you're baking in an oven. And unless you're over the Rocky Mountain front and in the mountains, summer isn't that much fun in Denver, Colorado. It's way, way too sunny. I know that sounds like a ridiculous complaint, but it's true. It's way too sunny. You feel like you're baking. We are in the best time of year here in Denver, September through January. Give me this year after year after year. I love it so much. How is it where you are, Dave?
So I guess in other words, what you're saying is right now in Denver, you cannot taste the humidity.
No, I can actually never taste the humidity. I have to drive east about 15 hours or about 12 hours to Iowa to taste the humidity.
Okay. So you can't recycle the final hurrah and you can't taste the humidity. Fair enough.
We're not in the final hurrah. We're in the penultimate hurrah.
Okay. Fall in the Northeast is always my favorite season. I don't know. It seems like climate change has made things a bit warmer than usual at this time in September, but this is around the time in New York City where you get some really nice, like 70-degree sunny days, and the weekend is shaping up to be really nice. And then as it gets closer to October, you can drive up into the Hudson Valley and see, go apple picking with the rest of the world and walk into a corn maze and see all the leaves and say, all right, I get it. It's gorgeous. But yeah, October generally is my favorite month to spend up in the Northeast. I'm a big fan of things that smell like campfires and going to Trader Joe's and seeing pumpkin spice everything. So
it's a good time of year. What else has been going on for you? You saw a concert here recently.
Yeah, I was actually up in Connecticut this past Sunday at the Westville Music Bowl. That was a gorgeous fall evening. That was like sunny and like 68 degrees. It was perfect. I saw the Trey Anastasio Band for the first time since, I think, April of 2019. I was at the Beacon Theater for the night when the Trey documentary premiered and Tab played like an hour-long set.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, obviously, there's been changes in Tab now with the late Tony Markelis. Dezron Douglas has taken over on bass and also at this show because, you know, as we said last week, James Casey is undergoing some cancer treatments. There was a different fill-in saxophone player.
Was it Kojima?
Yes, Kojima, who played a lot with the Dap Kings and his own like solo projects. And I guess not to dance on Tony's grave, but the rhythm section with Dezron Douglas was, I think, some of the most inventive Tab rhythm I've seen in quite a while, and I think added a significant degree of freshness that had been lacking. His bass lines are quite loose and nimble, but he really hits like a depth charge. And considering the immense catalog that Trey Anastasio has, I mean, he was able basically to play just about everything that was thrown at him. From, I mean, clearly, based upon Tab's set list, they're playing the standards a lot. There's a lot of Sand, a lot of Money, Love, and Change, a lot of Mozambique. So I'm thinking maybe they're doing more repeats because the fill-in guys have less stuff to learn. But, I mean, for me, the highlight of that Tab show was might have been Quantigy, which the bass line was just like low-slung, almost sounded kind of like Bill Withers, like Use Me levels of low-down funk. But I really enjoyed myself. I mean, obviously, it helped that it was outdoors and gorgeous. Westfield Music Bowl is a really nice venue, and I got to do it with my two closest friends in childhood who I've probably seen over between like 60 and 70 Fish and Trey shows with, so that was also totally great. But, you know, in the past, when Tab would come around, I would kind of say, oh, that's nice. Maybe if I got nothing else to do, I'll go check out Tab. But I had enough fun at that New Haven show that next time they come around, I'd be like, yeah, I've got to see Tab at least once a tour, maybe twice.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed all the Tab I've listened to. I mean, my issue with Tab throughout the years was that it you know, obviously what Trey did in 2001, 2002, 2003, it became this kind of sprawling mess of a band in some cases where you went into every show almost expecting to hear a 25 to 30 minute long jam. And he really, really used the horn section, you know, your Russell Remington, Peter Applebaum, Dave Grippo, that whole crew to just like expand the idea of these songs. And you get like a 25 minute first tube type of things, just absolute insanity from that band. And then when they came back in 2008, when Trey kind of reformed the band a little bit, tightened things up, really kind of seemed to use it as like a breeding ground for future Fish songs. And so there's so many songs that Fish has played over the last dozen years that kind of got their foundation and their like sea legs in Tab before eventually being debuted with Fish recently, like Set Your Soul Free, Soul Planet, Everything's Right. But prior to that, you know, you get a lot of the Joy songs. You know, you go back all the way to 99, 2000, First Tube, Sand. And it felt like, and I saw Tab in August of 2019. It was a great show. There really were no risks that were taken. It was a very tight show, and it was very clear that like Trey is almost using this as a centerpiece to kind of be in like the big late 70s, early 80s rock band of his dreams, where there's backup singers and horns, and there's a second percussionist. Like he gets this big orchestral sound. And it was cool, but it wasn't totally like a thing I felt like I needed to revisit on a regular basis. This is the first Tab tour since 2003 where I've listened to every single show the morning after it happens. I'm not streaming it. I'm not at that point yet. If they did a webcast, I'd probably watch a webcast. But like I'm listening to this tour, and I agree with you, so much creativity. And Rest in peace, Tony Markelis. There is no tab without Tony Markelis. There is no sand without Tony Markelis. He was an amazing bassist and, by all accounts, an amazing friend to Trey. But I'm right there with you. This tour has been super exciting.
But also, I mean, coming off a really hot Phish tour, Trey has utilized a lot of the different sound effects and the rig that he was using on the Phish tour. So there's also, in addition to some really delicious, clean Type 1 Trey, he definitely did take his effects with him. So it's just a combination of things. I mean, the fact that they went right into tab after a really hot Phish tour and they're going to go right into Phish fall tour.
Right.
It's just, you know, tab has been firing on all cylinders and it's been fun to see. Also, just want to mention the fact that kind of on the subject of people who play with Phish, on next week on September 28th, I am going to go to the Beacon Theater to see Primus. They play two sets. One set is, I guess, Greatest Hits, and the other set is Primus is playing Rush's 1977 opus, A Farewell to Kings, in full. I purposely stayed off YouTube because I know there's footage. I don't know what it's going to look like, but that's just 16-year-old Dave's head and face being melted at once. I'm sure everybody there is probably going to be between the age of 38 and 52, and there's just going to be a lot of dudes and beards, and God, that's like a dorky guy's night out if there ever was. So it's indoors, so I'll just mask up, and I'm very much looking forward to that.
Yeah, that's going to be amazing. That sounds like a absolute dream show for Dave.
But enough about me, Brian. What's been going on in Brinkman world?
Right now, my entire world consists of Undermine. I am pretty much like, I don't think I'm at the bottom of the ocean yet or at this point anymore. I think I'm like just midway through swimming back to the surface. I'm about 3/4 of the way through this season. We structured this season differently in a prep standpoint, mainly for quality control from a planning standpoint, and also for my sanity as I produced everything week to week last season. And so I'm ahead of the game, which feels good. We know where we're going. We've got a really good sense of what this season has in store, and we did a really great job of getting a ton of interviews booked early and all the scripting completed early. So it's really just me piecing some things together, and it feels really good right now. I'm really happy with the reception that we've received thus far, and I'm seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. I think I'm probably 2 to 3 weeks from the light, and when I reach there, I will feel very, very good. But for right now, I am buried. This is the time of year, I'm guessing, going forward for me to be buried. But I did have time to finish a great book, which I've been trying to maintain in between parenting, in between podcasting. I've been trying to maintain reading as much as possible. And I just have to recommend to everyone out there, in The Drop World, After the Fall by Ben Rhodes. It's a fantastic overview of Ben Rhodes worked for the Obama administration. He was in the, I think he worked within the NSA from a communication standpoint, but he's a really interesting guy. He's only a little bit older than me. I think he's in his early 40s at this point in time, has a really good perspective on the world. The book basically charts from the fall of the Berlin Wall to today, what America has created, what have been some of the mistakes, what have been some of the successes, what have been some of the challenges, and kind of taking a world view with specific focus on authoritarian regimes rising in Hungary, Russia, and China, in terms of kind of the next kind of larger battle for our minds across the world. So I greatly enjoyed it. I thought it was really relevant, and I think that listeners of The Drop would dig it as well. But those are kind of the two things, aside from chasing my kids around the house, that are going on with me. Beyond that, we're nearing the end of the baseball season. We have to include baseball chatter into our weekly discussion here. We're nearing the end of the baseball season. I think we have 1 week left. I think that next Sunday is the final date of the season as of time of posting. The Cubs have been losing like crazy, which was the goal all along with the sell-off. We went through a crazy 7 or 8 game winning streak in mid to late August, which people were like, why are we doing this right now? But we've been losing like crazy. We've been... the trend has been we take like a 5-run lead and then we blow it and we lose like 11-5. That's happened like 6 times in the last 10 days. It's been crazy. We end the season with, I think, 6 games against the Cardinals. I believe as of posting, we'll have just wrapped up a 3-game series with the Cardinals. And we're currently, as of time of recording, tied with the Twins for the 7th overall draft pick. I do hope that we can increase those chances so that this waste of a season that started with such strange hope and in May and early June, I was a buzz with, are these Cubs in contention? What's happening here? We threw a no-hitter on June 24th. It's been such a crazy ride, but I'm hoping that we can land somewhere around the 5th or 6th slot in the draft. That would be a good reward here. But how are things going for you, Dave? We had so much hope as of the last episode with the Mets. Maybe they had one final push in them, but I don't think it's to be.
The last enjoyable Mets game to watch was the Francisco Lindor 3-home run game against the Yankees a few Sundays ago. But it seems like the team is...
Which at the time felt like the best baseball game of the year, but now it looks like both New York teams are going to be out of the playoffs.
Yeah. I mean, I never felt all that comfortable with this Mets squad, even when they were like, I think like at most at their peak, it was like 10 games over 500 and like 4.5 games in first place. It just never quite sat right to me. Always felt like pretenders, could never put away teams when they had to put teams away. Frittered away tons of opportunities, so many one-run losses. And over the past 10 days, it seems like the run on fumes, they just basically gave up. I mean, there was issues, especially who they had to turn to in their starting rotation. But I don't know. I think it's a bit of an indictment of the culture around the team. I haven't watched them all in a few days. That's okay. Instead of baseball last night, I caught up and on Billions and watched 2 episodes of that instead and was probably a lot happier as opposed to watching the Mets lose 12-5 to the Boston Red Sox. But that's okay. Playoffs are coming up. Always a fun distraction. My team doesn't have to be in the playoffs for that to be enjoyable. I just don't want to see the St. Louis Cardinals in the playoffs because screw the St. Louis Cardinals.
Unfortunately. Well, I was texting with a Cardinals friend and I was like, I think you guys are peaking a little bit too early. Like they needed to go on a run to make the playoffs, but I'd be scared if I was a Cardinals fan and I'm coming off of an 11-game, as of time of recording, 11-game winning streak going into the playoffs. I think the only team that's really ever taken that to success was the 2007 Colorado Rockies that somehow made it to the World Series only to be swept by the Boston Red Sox.
God, that's right.
But, next couple weeks, yeah, we got playoff baseball. I'm really excited. I've resigned myself to the fact like the Cubs were eliminated weeks ago, so I'm back to my pre-2015 days of just kind of finding a team that has great players on it that plays in a good stadium, that plays in an agreeable state and city. It usually lands me on rooting for like the San Francisco Giants, the LA Dodgers, the Boston Red Sox. I think I went through my list last week and most of those teams seem to have been eliminated from the playoffs. So I don't want to see the Braves do anything. I think that they're an incredibly boring team and I don't really want to see them do anything this year. I definitely don't want to see the Cardinals or the Brewers have any success. I hope that both of those teams are embarrassed in the playoffs. But I'm going to be enjoying West Coast baseball and rooting for Kyle Schwarber with the Red Sox or Chris Bryant with the Giants. That's kind of where I'm at. But quickly, transitioning from the end of the baseball season and the playoffs that are coming to spring, which we know brings renewal, which we know brings new opportunity. And for us, I don't know what our spring will look like from a baseball standpoint, but I do know that we have our eyes set on a music festival that was announced, I think, last week. Knoxville, Tennessee's Big Ears Festival. This has been going on for a few years, and it always seems to bring to it a fantastic lineup of artists. And we took quite note of the list that was revealed here about a week to 10 days ago. And I'm just going to throw it out in the universe. This should be the drop's first across state lines field trip. There are so many artists that we have recommended that we have loved listening to that are playing at this festival. I'm really excited for it. What do you think?
Yeah, this is pretty bonkers. This is anytime you can get $75 bill, low, M.D. Mokhtar, Bonnie Light Horseman, Joshua Abrams, Natural Information Society, Mary Lattimore, Jeff Parker, Animal Collective, and Bill Callahan in the same festival, you say, oh, wow, please and thank you. Yes, this is those artists kind of only scratch the surface of what's there. It's one of the best avant-garde festivals in America. And I've never been to Knoxville, Tennessee. I'm told it's actually a great city in Tennessee that kind of gets lost in the shuffle between, you know, Nashville and Memphis and whatnot. But it's supposedly a great place to see such a thing. I mean, most of what I know from Knoxville is that they had the World's Fair there, and there's a Simpsons episode where they see the Sun Sphere, which is loaded with wigs. But I would, if somehow we could swing a drop trip to Big Ears, I wouldn't hate it.
No, it would be great. And this was one of those festivals where I was looking through the lineup and, like, you know, sometimes you see some of these lineups and, like, you obviously know, like, the large print bands, you know, the middle print bands, you know, the middle small print bands, and then you get way down into the weeds and you know, it's a lot of artists that are signed on because either their record label is close with the organization that's launching the festival or, you know, whatever it may be. This was one of those I just kept going through as, like, the font was getting smaller and smaller, and I had to, like, zoom in on the overall map, and I was like, oh my God, they're playing here? So, you know, like Cassandra Jenkins, Jeff Parker, Fenizes, Nubia Garcia, even Bonnie Light Horseman are going to play there, Theon Cross. Pretty much, if you've listened to us on The Drop or if you've listened to us on Beyond the Pond, these are artists that we have pushed on a regular basis, and to have them all be in one festival is really exciting because there's the potential for, you know, either sit-ins, but also it's just really cool to see all these artists kind of under one
roof. Yeah, I think we're kind of even burying the lead. I think that there's a big John Zorn component to it this year as well. Like, I think John Zorn curated a lot of the artists. I think he's doing a lot of sit-ins. I think there's, like, a lot of tributes to his Masada band, but obviously that guy's discography is worth about 17 different podcasts to it. So, yeah, the bottom line is we're excited about this. I may need to start pushing the wife a little earlier than usual to get me down there.
Likewise. So. Before we jump into the big discussion of the week, what have you been listening to on Osiris Media?
So a podcast that I was listening to this week that I was really enjoying was called The Lost Highway with Daniel Donato. And he interviewed a Texas singer-songwriter named Vincent Neil Emerson. Now, Daniel Donato, he's like 25 years old. He is a kind of Nashville-based, shit-hot Telecaster prodigy. He's an extremely good, extremely in-demand Telecaster player who kind of has tethered himself to the genre he likes to call cosmic country. He put out his debut album in 2020 last year called, I think it was called A Young Man's Country, which was kind of a...
Oh, yeah.
It was really good. It's like sort of a jam bandish-leaning country record. Like, he sings with a killer twang. He's definitely, you hear him, you're like, okay, he's clearly playing a Telecaster, but it goes off with some really fantastic long playing, like jam bandy directions. I know he does like a 9-minute cover of the Dead's Fire on the Mountain, which is totally great. There's some originals. There's an Angel from Montgomery cover. It's just one of the better country adjacent records I heard last year. And I think his podcast, which Osiris recently started hosting, has about 50 episodes at this point, where he just really enthusiastically interviews all sorts of like luminaries from the country music world. And this guy, Vincent Neil Emerson, I think he's like 29 years old. He just put out his second album last month, which is kind of one of the better, like, traditional country records I've heard this year. And it's just a fun podcast because Donato is a really fun guy. He really gets into it. He has a lot of enthusiasm. He does a lot of research on his guests. And I think he may have actually only just gone to his first ever Phish concert in Nashville this past year. I know he contributes a cover of Back on the Train to the excellent Clusterfies compilation that Jambase put out earlier this year. But it's going to have to go back and listen to some of the episodes because he really seems to capture a lot of really interesting subjects. And he's an engaging guy. And I think his second record, which I think has like the word Cosmic Country in the title, is coming out like next month as well. So that's certainly something worth looking for. Lost Highway with Daniel Donato.
Nice. Yeah, that's an incredible podcast. I'm glad that we were able to bring that over. And awesome, awesome album from last year. I'm going to recommend one of my favorite podcasts on Osiris Media. I'm not sure if I've recommended it here in this space yet, but it is Southern Songs and Stories, hosted by Joe Kendrick. It's one of the original podcasts on Osiris Media. And he recently released an episode called Going All In, The Legacy of Willie Nelson on Country Music. And it's just a massive, massive deep dive into the world of Willie Nelson, his impact in country music, the advocacy that he utilizes within his career, his overall career trajectory, you know, from the time that he made a rise in the late 1950s through the Redheaded Strangers release in 1975 to Stardust. His release in 1977, which defied all critical predictions that it would sink his overall career, to his impact on Austin City Limits, as well as you know, the impact on Austin overall, to you know, kind of his how he predated alt country and the rise of bands like Jason Isbell and Wilco, and kind of, you know, the larger scene around both Nashville, Austin, and kind of the alt country vibe of that we hear throughout popular music today. So it's a fantastic episode. It's a fantastic overview of one of the pioneers in larger music. I've only seen Willie Nelson once live. I saw him at of all places, Eric Clapton's Crossroads Festival in 2007. A show that I went to with my dad and baked in the sun all day. Jeff Beck, though, was a fantastic show later in the evening of that night. But this is a great way to dive into Southern Songs and Stories. Again, it's a great podcast hosted by the fantastic Joe Kendrick, and this episode on Willie Nelson is one that all listeners of The Drop would enjoy. And with that, let's get to the big discussion. So, it is Monday, September 27th, but we wanted to utilize this time and space to highlight a record that dropped 30 years ago this past Friday on September 24th, mainly because, you know, we're entering a crazy fall. I think that most people who listen to The Drop recognize this, but like, one of our favorite people on Twitter, Mr. Queen City Jams, Jams with a Z, posted a picture back in March of like 7 cassette tapes, and it was like Nirvana's Nevermind, Soundgarden's Bad Motor Finger, Pearl Jam's 10, Red Hot Chili Peppers' Blood Sugar Sex Magik, and a few others. And he just said, these records were all released within 44 days of each other in the fall of 1991. The fall of 91 is absolutely insane. We did a few weeks ago in our classic album segment of the show. We did 1991, I'm guessing 5 or 6 episodes ago. And I read through all these records that were released in 91, and it was just mind-blowing what came out at that point in time. So we wanted to talk about a record that was released 30 years ago on September 24th, which also happened to be Dave's 12th birthday. Happy belated birthday to you, Dave. Dave is now, you can do the math and figure out how old he is now. Amazing record that was released on Dave's 12th birthday, which is the Red Hot Chili Peppers' Blood Sugar Sex Magik. And we wanted to do a appreciation deep dive into where this record is 30 years on. David, tell me about your thoughts on Blood Sugar Sex Magik. Why was it awesome then? and still is now.
Man, every day I get older. I just turned 42. Blood sugar sets magic stays the same age. I mean, I don't want to be gross or sound immature, but it might be the best album ever with which to navigate puberty, because when you're 12 years old, like I was when it came out, I mean, I was 12. I don't think I really got into it until I was like 13, because I think the first single was Suck My Kiss, but the album didn't really take off until Under the Bridge came out several months later. But Anthony Kiedis just says things on this record that would cause a 12 and 13-year-old boy's mind, like sparks, would just shoot off. Like, there's almost every song is about some kind of girl. He references his erection 3 or 4 times in the songs, like Without Shame. And the whole thing just has like a very laid-back, very funky, very inviting vibe, and I think there's like 17 or 18 songs. It's a ridiculously large record. I just keep thinking of this back as it was growing up. It's like a fantasy world. If you're just like a boy in the suburbs, starting to notice girls for the first time, this album is your guide to the cosmos. But yet, at 42 years of age, I still listen to it because the songs hold up. I mean, obviously, there's the singles. There's Under the Bridge, there's Breaking the Girl, there's the classic Give It Away, but even the deep cuts, like Mellowship Slinky in B Major is a great song, Funky Monks, Sir Psycho Sexy, lyrics are a little bit embarrassing.
Quite.
But me and my buddies can still sing that song to each other just because it's we've memorized all the verses of Sir Psycho Sexy. Remember, that was one of the tapes I had on one of the Maxell XL2, like the yellow and pink, not XL2, one of like, I think it was like a Memorex yellow and pink tapes that were popular with 13 and 14 year olds in the early 90s. I had that at summer camp. And that to me was something I could just put on and like go off into my own world. What about you, Brian?
Yeah, like I'm struck by the instant nostalgia around this record because I feel that the same way as well. I hadn't listened to this record in probably 15 years before this past week when we decided that we should do a deep dive on it. And part of the reason, like, I felt like it was important for us to do a deep dive on it was like, this was a formative record for me at a very important time in my life. I met one of my best friends, Rob Brennan, huge shout out, at Supermoon Beer Co. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I met him very early in freshman year. I think it was like an orientation in freshman year where you were like grouped based on last name. We bonded for some reason over the Orgy cover of Blue Monday. We just both thought it was awesome, which was a very strange way to open up a lifelong friendship.
That's weird.
Quite weird. But it was when we both went through Red Hot Chili Peppers and Smashing Pumpkins obsessions midway through our freshman year in high school that our lifelong friendship was solidified. We saw the Pumpkins on the Machina tour. We were like 5 rows back on the floor at the Aragon Ballroom from Billy Corgan, and it was an absolute incredible concert experience, one of the best concerts I've ever seen. 2 years later, we would go through an intense period of a fish obsession, and we both got into fish at the same time. All this led us to a muddy field in Vermont, and all of this is tied back to Blood Sugar Sex Magic, which was just a completely formative record for me at a formative time. Some of my best friendships were formed at that point. To your point, it's one of those records that you hear it between the ages of like 11 and 15. I don't think that it would impact you in any sort of way beyond 15 on this sort of level, but it feels wrong best way possible. You know, it was one of the soul rock records that had the parental advisory on it. There was something about it that was really mysterious. Obviously, there's like the huge sexual overtones that Anthony Kiedis throws out throughout the record that like at that age feels like you're really doing something wrong, but also feels educational in a very strange way to be a suburban white kid in their early teenage years and listen to this record. You feel like you're being let in on a bunch of jokes and information that like has just been hidden from you for your, for the entirety of your childhood, rightly so. But you know, listening back to it, I had a lot of thoughts. Like, first and foremost, this record, it's at a really interesting point in the Chili Peppers' career. You know, the arc for me of Freaky Styley through Californication is one of my favorite album runs that any band has gone on. You hear this band that is just like a funk party band that's emerging in Los Angeles, start to evolve their songwriting in Uplift Mofo Party Plan, Mother's Milk, really peak in a lot of ways on Blood Sugar Sex Magik, and then go through this wilderness year in One Hot Minute with a revitalization in Californication. You also get Rick Rubin, this hyper famous massive producer that has produced so many big albums over the last 30 or 40 years, who is in a abandoned mansion in Los Angeles with the guys from Red Hot Chili Peppers, just working with them to create a masterpiece. I remember watching the Behind the Music on the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and for whatever reason, they talked about the part at the end of Breaking the Girl where Flea is taking like a 2x4 and hitting a barrel, like an empty oil drum, to make that sound, and just being like fascinated by the recording process. You get funk, which for me, a couple years later, when I got into Phish, one of the big fascinations I had with Phish was that, whoa, they had a funk year in their career. What in the hell is this about? And just like the idea of rock music incorporating funk was something that became a fascination for me. And then also the idea of like an album as a tome. You know, this is an 18 song record. I think it suffers a little bit on the back half of the record. It could be an incredibly tight 12 or 13 song album. But, you know, the first, I want to say 11 songs, basically everything through Blood Sugar Sex Magik, the title track, is absolute gold and flows perfectly, even if there are regrettable moments on it. Sir Psycho Sexy is one of the most embarrassing songs that anyone has ever put to tape, but I agree with you. There is a unique quality to being a suburban white kid listening to that record or listening to that song and learning the verses and thinking that like you've uncovered something just like mysterious. And also I will say the jam that leads out of Sir Psycho Sexy is phenomenal. It's like so groove driven, and Frusciante and Flea just lock in such a perfect way.
Yeah, that's the thing about the record, is that it feels like the first record where John Frusciante truly comes into his own. The first album he appeared on was the one before that, Mother's Milk, which is sort of like a more metallic LA hair metal version of the Chili Peppers. It doesn't sound that divorced from the sound that Hillel Slovak had, but certainly the tagline on the Chili Peppers is generally Anthony Kiedis is a clown, but I love John Frusciante and Flea. And the reason is that Frusciante gets a variety of very interesting, very slinky tones, and you can kind of tell it's exactly who it is within just like 30 seconds of hearing him play. And despite the fact that I think the Chili Peppers have gone through him like four or five different guitar players, it seems like he's really the only guitarist who actually belongs in the band. Whereas, I mean, granted, he wasn't a founding member. I think Hillel Slovak was the founding guitarist, but they might have recorded the first two albums with guitarists other than Hillel, but he's the full-time guitarist in Uplift Mofo Party Plan before he overdosed on heroin. But, I mean, to me, kind of like from my experience with the Chili Peppers, Frusciante is where it really begins, irrespective of the fact that the second record, Freaky Styley, produced by George Clinton, that's very good.
Hillel's on that record as well. And I believe he was on, I believe he was on the first record. But yeah, Hillel is,
it's like Jack Sherman is a fill-in guitarist, like at some point.
Yeah, I mean, Hillel and Kiedis were like brothers in arms, and Hillel, Kiedis, and Flea, the three of them, like really signified the, you know, the tube sock wearing Chili Peppers in LA clubs in the mid 1980s. Frusciante, you know, probably had, I mean, he was like 16 or 17 years old when he joined the Chili Peppers, and they were his favorite band at the time. And it was like the greatest opportunity of his entire life. But I agree with you. He is the guitarist who has taken the Chili Peppers sound and expanded it. Blood Sugar Sex Magic is just an amazing guitar record to listen to. Hearing him come back on Californication and really evolve his overall guitar prowess. What he was able to do with that, with playing in a band like this that initially sounded like it was very limited, but became a huge, huge stadium band that had a wide variety of sounds, was really just like inventive from an overall guitar standpoint. At one point, Rolling Stone ranked him as the 18th best guitarist of all time, which I think was kind of a mistake. He was re-ranked in like the 60s, about 6 or 7 years later, which is probably a bit more accurate, but he is fascinating. His story overall is just like one of the most endearing in rock music. The way that he played with his dream band, they became way too much, fell into drug addiction, which if you read about his addiction he went through, he claims he never was sad during his addiction, that he was depressed otherwise. He felt the happiest he ever was when he was addicted, and thought that he doesn't regret the period in time where he was addicted to heroin. Instead, he looks at it as an essential part of his overall journey, and now is by all accounts sober, incredibly healthy, highly creative, and has just rejoined the Red Hot Chili Peppers, which I think is a win for the band and for him overall.
I think allegedly there was like a record near completion before the pandemic hit. So one has to hope that that's going to come out sooner or later. Otherwise, kind of what was the point of him rejoining?
The live shows.
Okay. Yeah, for the live shows. His arc is fascinating. His solo records are, I would say with Frusciante's solo records, your mileage may vary.
Yeah, his, I'm blanking on the title of it, but his record that came out in, I believe, 2002, How to Clean Water in 10 Days, something like that. It's a really,
that was good.
Really
was
good record.
Yeah, some of the earlier ones, I think like Smile from the Streets You Hold and like Los Lanius, usually just a t-shirt, are kind of a deep dive into a somewhat disturbed mind. I don't enjoy playing those records. But yeah, the one from 2002, kind of around the time of By the Way, is quite good if memory serves.
To record Only Water for 10 Days, it came out in 2001. And yeah, that's a great record.
Okay, yes. I know you said, you told me in the past that you kind of got off board after Californication, but I would argue that both By the Way and especially Stadium Arcadium definitely has some gold worth mining. I mean, Stadium Arcadium being, I think, God, I think I have recently talked about it not too long ago on this podcast, like the ridiculous blown out double album that actually probably has like 75 minutes worth of interesting Frusciante stuff. But then, yeah, the two Josh Klinghoffer records after that are mostly Diet Frusciante, unremarkable. But, you know, I'm very curious to see what the next record's going to be like.
I loved One Hot Minute. I thought it was a really interesting departure. And I love watching bands like make that kind of follow-up destructive record. And obviously having Dave Navarro in the band completely changed the dynamic and the sound of the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I was really into the band when Californication came out, and that whole process of like they released this incredible moment in time record in Blood Sugar Sex Magic, have 5 years of trying to figure out how to follow it up with all these intraband controversies. They bring on Dave Navarro from Jane's Addiction, make this very seedy follow-up dark record that has some really fantastic songwriting on it. Take another 4 years from One Hot Minute through Californication, get John Frusciante back. He's sober, he's clean, he's healthy, and they suddenly figure out a way to write, like, you know, adult contemporary mid-tempo singles that everybody loves, along with, you know, kind of throwbacks to some of their best work from when they were younger. It's kind of an update on who the Chili Peppers were, and to me, I think it's their best record, Californication. Beyond that, I kind of started to move past that type of period of listening for myself. And
you'd like, by the way, especially with your like ambient leanings, by the way, it's definitely like the quietest, most considered, spaciest record. I think it's really at the time I thought it was, they had upped the wuss factor a bit too much for their own good, but I'd put it in their top three.
I will give it another chance.
Kind of to close out the conversation, I want to say that both Kiedis and Flea have both written memoirs. Anthony Kiedis' memoir, Scar Tissue, came out in 2005. Flea, more recently, I think in 2019, released Acid for Children, a copy of which was given to me by our good buddy, John Prue. Shout out to his podcast, Deeper Listening. Thanks, John. That Flea memoir is kind of like a pretty like whimsical look at his childhood and growing up. It's pretty fun and light, and you kind of see where his head is at, and it kind of ends right when the Chili Peppers begin. But if you had to read one of the two, I would pick up Kiedis' Scar Tissue, which is kind of a literary equivalent of Blood Sugar Sex Magic, in that it's so, makes you feel so dirty, but it's so entertaining. You just can't put it down. You just keep saying, what? How are you alive? It's everything you want from like a trashy rock and roll memoir.
All right, we're back to chat about new music that we recommend, as well as old music that we recommend. Like we do every week, we're going to give you each one album that we recommend that has come out recently, as well as we're going to continue our deep dive back in time with a classic summer album from 1971. What a year in music. Dave, what is your new record that you are going to recommend?
So my new record is by an artist named Brandy Younger. The album is called Somewhere Different, and the song we're going to play is called Reclamation. At the top of this podcast, we had talked about the bass player Desiron Douglas, who's in Tab right now. Brandy Younger is a jazz harpist, and she's also Desiron Douglas' partner. I'm not sure if they're married, but they've lived together, and actually a series of webcasts that they did when they were in quarantine turned into the lovely album Force Majeure, which came out last year. It's one of my favorite albums to come out last year. So Somewhere Different is an album Brandy Younger put out as a harpist and a band leader. And personnel on the record include Maurice Mobetta Brown on trumpet, Rashawn Carter on bass, although Desiron Douglas plays bass in the first song, as well as there's contributions from the legendary bass player Ron Carter. There's Chelsea Barras in tenor sax, Ann Drummond on flute, Alan Menard and Marcus Gilmore on drums. So basically, if you have a love of the soul jazz records put out in the early to mid-70s on the CTI label, you will find a lot to enjoy here. Clearly, when people talk about jazz harp, the first thing that comes to mind is Alice Coltrane. However, really, this is much more in the vein of the jazz, soul jazz harpist Dorothy Ashby, whose Afro Harpin record, which I think came out, I want to say, in 1968, is kind of a big touchstone for what Brandy Younger is doing. This is just a really excellent, very well produced, by Desiron Douglas, actually, soul jazz record, which puts the harp centered, and it's, you know, very almost entirely instrumental. I think one of the songs has a guest vocalist, but really it's just a very breezy, excellent, psychedelic jazz harp record that it sounds great. There's plenty of hooks within, and I think if you like this podcast, you would enjoy it highly. So let's listen to the song Reclamation off of Somewhere Different by Brandy Younger.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to need to cue that up right after this recording. That is fantastic and right up my alley. And more on Alice Coltrane later. All right, my record of choice for this week really doesn't stray too far a foot from my standard listening habits, but it has to be recommended because it is phenomenal. It will be one of my favorite records of the year. Bob Dylan's The Bootleg Series, Volume 16, Springtime in New York, documenting his bootlegs from 1980 to 1985. Close listeners of this podcast and close followers of me on Twitter will be surprised to know I am a Bob Dylan diehard fan. Probably the last period. Yeah, a little bit, just a little bit. Probably the last period of his career that like I spent significant time with was the early 1980s. He's usually derided because of the heavily evangelical records of the time. His live shows were suffering, and he released what many people consider, I'm not one of them, but many people consider his worst album ever, Empire Burlesque. With Dylan and with the Bootleg Series, you get one of two things. The Bootleg Series, this is his 16th volume. He's been releasing these since the early 1990s. You get one of two things with these Bootleg Series. You either get in the vein of like the 1965 to 66 Bootleg Series that came out about 5 or 6 years ago, or the Basement Tapes Bootleg Series, or the More Blood, More Tracks Bootleg Series. This vision and this picture into how much Dylan was creating at a certain period in time that was a peak period where like you hear the peak music that Dylan was making in his standard records and his live shows that came out of the era. And now, oh my God, there's like 150 other songs that we have to hear from this, alternate takes that are better than the originals. Oh my God. But the alternative is you get these great bootleg series like Another Self-Portrait or Trouble No More or this one, Springtime in New York, that showcase heavily derided periods in Dylan's career that actually contain so many gems and are so fun to live in if you spend the time doing it. And this record is like that. You hear Mark Knopfler all over the record, and you hear this kind of alternative idea of what would have happened if Dylan had put Brownsville Girl on Empire Burlesque, if he had put the Bootleg Series version of When the Night Comes Falling from the Sky, as well as this Bootleg 16 version of Dark Eyes on Empire Burlesque. That album could have been a freaking classic, and the entire idea of what Bob Dylan was in the mid-1980s would have been rethought. So we are going to listen to, the alternative take of Joker Man off of the Bootleg Series Volume 16, which I love the version of Joker Man that opens up Infidels. I think it's one of the best songs that Dylan's ever recorded and released. But this version is so smooth. You can hear the lyrics so much clearer. It's such a fantastic take on it. So let's go ahead here and listen to Joker Man off of Springtime in New York City.
Joker Man danced to the Nightingale tune. Bird fly high by the light of the moon. Whoa. Say goodbye to no one. No store-bought shirt for you on your back. One of the women must sit in the shack and sew one. Shedding off one more layer of skin. Keeping one step ahead of the persecutor within.
All right. So our last segment of the show, we are going to talk about great albums from 1971. Before we do that, we are coming very close to the end of the show. I promise. Thank you, everyone who has hung out with us at this point in time. I just want to highlight how incredible of a year 1971 was for music. So I'm just going to do a rapid fire. These were some of the albums that were released in 1971. Bowie's Hunky Dory, Led Zeppelin IV, Joni Mitchell Blue, Rolling Stones' Sticky Fingers, The Who, Who's Next, Can, Tagomago, John Prine's self-titled record, Carole King, Tapestry, Paul McCartney, Ram, Marvin Gaye, What's Going On, Bill Withers, Just As I Am, Lennon's Imagine, T-Rex, Electric Warrior, Funkadelic, Maggot Brain, Yes, Fragile, And that is just like a small, small sample size of records that were released in 1971. It is one of the great years in rock history, and we wanted to highlight it in our own unique way. David, what record are you recommending to us from 1971?
That list you described is definitely like an aging Rolling Stone writer's fantasy. That's it is incredible the amount of landmark fucking records that came out in 1971, 50 years ago. So one that I am going to highlight is one of my favorite records from that year. It's an incredibly mysterious record, despite having heard it many, many times. I still quite can't figure it out. It is David Crosby's If I Could Only Remember My Name, and the song we're going to play is Laughing, which I believe has Jerry Garcia on pedal steel. To me, when I think about this record, I think of the dark end of the hippie dream, as it were. I mean, Woodstock, that ended a few years earlier. The Summer of Love was long gone, and this just sounds like the bowl has been cashed. I mean, this album kind of stems from a dark period in David Crosby's life. Prior to recording, his very young girlfriend was killed in a car accident. I believe she was just trying to bring their cat to the veterinarian. Somebody ran a stop sign. And he recorded this record with a lot of luminaries from the scene, a lot of members of the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane. I think they referred to it as Planet Earth Rock Roll Orchestra. I know that Phil Lesh had a part in this record. As I said, Jerry Garcia had a part in this record. I think Graham Nash. It's kind of it's a very moody, dark, psychedelic folk record that has a lot of legs, and some of like the later tracks in the record almost kind of sound like stuff the Animal Collective was doing in like the mid-2000s. Some of the recording techniques, it sounds very much ahead of its time. So you have mood pieces like Laughing, like Traction in the Rain, Music is Love. Of course, there's the epic two-guitar duel in Cowboy Movie, which kind of is the closest David Crosby's ever come to doing like a Neil Young-type epic. It's a very interesting record, and I'm very much looking forward to the forthcoming season of the Osiris podcast, Freak Flag Flying, where for its 50th anniversary, I know Crosby and his buddy Steve Silverman are supposed to go into detail about it. I know that there's a big like vinyl reissue coming out. It's a fascinating record that's definitely worth doing a deep dive into. So let's listen to Laughing off David Crosby's If I Could Only Remember My Name.
I was mistaken. Oh.
So I said earlier that I was, I said more on Alice Coltrane later, and that is because I'm going to feature Alice Coltrane's 1971 record, Journey in Satkendanada. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. Journey in Satkendanada. If I'm mispronouncing that, just call me out on Twitter. I won't be offended. But this is a phenomenal record by Alice Coltrane. I've been wanting to feature Alice Coltrane for some time here on The Drop, and I'm glad I finally have the opportunity to. The small benefits of the pandemic, if you will, where I had a lot of time early in spring of 2020 to just listen to a lot of music. I wasn't going anywhere, and Aquarium Drunkard at the time, I think, had like 15 straight days of free Aquarium Drunkard radio that just ran on and on and on. And there was so much Alice Coltrane played. And it led me into a springtime Alice Coltrane deep dive in the spring of 2020, which has continued to this day. Absolutely love her work. She was the wife of John Coltrane, later became a recording artist in her own right and recorded some amazing records through the 1970s. And even into there are still releases coming out even today, that chart her work in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s before she passed away in 2007. This record is up there with her best records of all time. My favorite record of hers is 1973's Lord of Lords, but this record features Pharoah Sanders, which is incredible. It also tracks her inspiration from Swami Satyadananda. I'm so sorry if I'm butchering that, as she was moving into Hinduism, which would define her larger life from a spiritual standpoint. It's an incredible record. It's a great introduction to experimental jazz, and it's a great opportunity to hear the work of Alice Coltrane from a harp standpoint, from a keyboard standpoint, from just a larger jazz standpoint. It's beautiful. It's mind-altering. And all of it under 40 minutes. It's the type of record that you can throw on and, dive into and then move on with your day, which is really something you don't typically get with experimental jazz. The record that we're going to play here, or the song we're going to play here, I should say, is Something About John Coltrane, which comes on side B of the record and is a testament to her late husband. So we're going to listen here to Alice Coltrane's Journey in Satyadananda.
So, thank you for hanging with me and Brian on The Drop today. Very much enjoyed talking about new records, records from 1971, and the delicious, guilty, and important pleasure that is the Red Hot Chili Peppers' Blood Sugar Sex Magik. So, come back next week. We'll all hold hands. We'll all do Kumbaya. I'm sure we will find something equally fascinating to discuss. And we will all do The Drop.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Freights from The Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective. The only podcast you crank up to 11.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.